May 9th, 2007, and I'm continuing our interviews with Hank Loeffler. And up to this point, we've talked about his service in many different areas, and most recently in terms of our conversation in the Dean's Office in the School of Education. But now he is positioned to begin a new responsibility.
Well, it all began one afternoon. I had left the Madison City Council. My term had ended, my last term had ended in April of 93, so I had left the City Council, and somewhere in the late winter of 93-94, an old friend of mine, Mike Williamson, with whom I worked when he was Mayor Joe Sensenbrenner's chief of staff, and I had been on the council, so we had worked together on a number of difficult issues. Mike Williamson came into my office in the education building. Do you want to see if it's working, Art?
No, it's fine.
Came into my office in the education building and said, "Well, I have something for you to consider. We've done a study of how David Ward has been as chancellor, and we've interviewed all these deans and directors and other people, and the study recommends that David have a chief of staff in his office who can provide day-to-day management of issues, because right now Wayne McGowan, who has the job, is doing big issues like the research park and things like that that take him away from the office and is not available to either supervise the staff or not available to work on the, shall we say, the management issues that come in, the sudden phone calls, the crises that develop, and so forth. And perhaps you'd like to consider taking this job. In fact, we've kind of thought about the campus and who might be good." And then he went on to flatter me about why I might be good in this job. That is to say, I wasn't on the city council anymore, which was one of my big selling points. But I had been very credible on the city council, and I was currently on the academic staff executive committee, and I knew campus governance. I served on all of these campus-wide committees for 15 years. And I sort of knew the politics of the community, which was something that Chancellor Ward didn't know and was concerned about. And at that time, we had tried some fitful adventures in South Madison with some programs, but they hadn't worked out too well. And so maybe my community experience would help, and the fact that I'd run a whole bunch of statewide campaigns going back 20 years gave me some sense of the legislative politics. And so the long and the short of it was, maybe I understood the politics and maybe I understood the campus, and maybe I should consider going to work in the chancellor's office. So that was the sort of the beginning of it. And he left me with a whole variety of pieces of information, which were the results essentially of the study that he had carried out. Which went around, he'd gone around and interviewed deans and other people. And basically the comments came back that in order to be successful as a chancellor, he needed somebody who would come in and take over this day-to-day management stuff, which would free him up, because when he talked, he tended to talk about the vision of the university, not the day-to-day crises, and so he'd free him up to do what he did best, and so forth and so on. And the existing staff, when they were interviewed, said, "Well, the place is too chaotic. There's nobody really telling us what to do. So morale is not very high, and we missed Donna Shalala." And because there were a number of women who had been brought into that office by Donna who missed Donna Shalala. There were a number of other women whom Donna had fired that didn't miss Donna Shalala, but there was at least, "Gosh, this guy is just not like Donna Shalala." And I suppose that whenever there's a regime change in the chancellor's office, people, the devil that you know has left, and everybody feels positively toward them, and the new person hasn't settled in yet. So it's, so you're reading through all of this, And then David Ward, well, not David Ward, but Maria Giustigliano, who was his right-hand assistant, who describes herself as the chancellor's handmaiden, anyway, with a Phi Beta Kappa key around her neck. Anyway, Maria called on the phone and said, the chancellor, using the usual royal language, the chancellor would like you to join him for breakfast at such and such a time at such and such a place. Can you do that? And the place that David had selected, or the office had selected, was, gosh, it's not there anymore. Or maybe it is there. The bakery place right at the entrance of Sherwood, the Ovens of Brittany.
Yeah, no, it's gone.
It's gone. And that's where they made morning buns and things. They had a bakery and all of that. So we went there, and I sat down, I later came to know, of course, that these were the sorts of meetings that David hated, because he hated cold calls with people he didn't know, and he would be expected to somehow or other make a connection with them in a short period of time, and he did much better over the long term with relationships rather than in these first meetings. He also did best of all with large crowds, so strangely, the more narrow the crowd became, the fewer the people that were there, the more bashful he became in what I later have come to understand was just, he had a shyness with some people. If somebody started to tell him off, he would be a bear, but he just was shy in these kinds of one-on-one encounters where he hadn't found his way yet. And we can talk more about styles of leadership and styles of meeting later on, but so basically he said, well, I'd like you to consider this. Let's do it, no hard feelings. If you could come in and be my chief of staff for a year, at the end of the year, either one of us can say goodbye and there won't be any hard feelings. So there was this sort of oral agreement that I would do this on a temporary basis. And in fact, people were not sure about the position and they weren't sure about me. And so I wound up being called interim executive assistant for the payroll records. And we didn't stick me with the interim title for public purposes, but at least for the first year on the payroll, I was an interim so that I could just be asked, well, anybody serving at the pleasure of the chancellor, I suppose, could be asked to leave at any time. But what we set up was this sort of, either one of us can say this just didn't work out, because, and I would never leave the School of Education. My appointment there, I had indefinite status, which meant basically that I wasn't going anywhere anyway. But throughout the entire time I was in Bascom, and this is not an unusual story, there are a lot of people in Bascom who are really never there. You're payrolled somewhere else, or you're on, there's some other way that the university keeps track of you so that you have only a modest staff level in some of those central offices, because faculty have departmental appointments and other people have appointments here and there, and so you wind up with people being payrolled someplace else, and I never left the School of Education. And in fact, the greatest fiction of all, I suppose, was that for most of the time I was in the Chancellor's office, I was 25% still in education.
Who was dean at that point?
Let's see.
When you went up.
Yeah, 94, we were sort of in an interim period in the School of Education, because we had had a series of failed searches for dean, and so this was kind of an interregnum period. Henry Trueba had been let go by Chancellor Shalala, and there was this kind of, and then there were interim deans, and one person accepted the job, and then she said she didn't want to come, but she might come in a year, and so everybody waited a year, and then she said she didn't want to come, and it was one of those unfortunate sets of circumstances, and ultimately, after the substantial passage of time, Chuck Reed became dean of the School of Education, and in the meantime, I'd already worked with him for 3 or 4 years up in Bascom, because he was the interim dean of the graduate school. So you had all of these interims all over the place, and sometimes the institution doesn't catch up with its searches and its vacancies. So the salary was agreed upon. I'm sure I got a 10% raise, and they sent the money down to the School of Education faithfully, and I continued to do the School of Education. The deal that I had with Mike Sokobiak, who I believe was the interim dean then, that I ultimately had with Chuck Reed was, if I can't find pots of money somewhere in Bascom that will benefit the School of Education, then, you know, you're getting a bad deal for the 25%. But we were usually, at that time, able to, there was money, and it was possible to send down money for one-time initiatives from the provost or elsewhere, and so that was the quid pro quo. So the whole thing kind of was done on a wink and a smile and a handshake. David Ward also said to me, one of the things I said to David Ward, we have complete disclosure here, I said to him, you know that I'm gay, and you know that I've been in a relationship with my partner who lives in New York for 20 years. And he said, that doesn't matter. And I said, well, okay. And then he said, well, you're not gonna hold any press conferences about that, are you? And, you know, this was a pretty civilized discussion for 1994. And I said, no. I mean, that's, in my experience on the city council and elsewhere, you know, the number of times that comes up as an issue is not very many times at all, if ever. Though in the first month, John Torfey and I were down talking to Tammy Baldwin about the student health insurance and domestic partners, so I was wrong at least about that issue. And that's something else that we need to talk about, because I became more sophisticated in the ways and guiles and wiles of John Torfey in that office, and have come to appreciate how we worked out that domestic partner issue, which we actually did 2 years later. But it took a little while, and it took some crafty maneuvering to figure out how to deal with it. So that was fine, and David and Judith Ward, and ultimately I said, okay, let me consider this to David Ward. Because one of the other things that I didn't want to do was to suddenly emerge in the chancellor's office, though ultimately David did call together the whole staff and anybody else he could find to say that I had arrived. But I said, you know, I really think I need to go around and get some advice from people I've known about how things are in Bascom and so forth. I've known a lot of people up in Bascom Hall. Let me just do some, I didn't use the phrase due diligence, but let me just go see. And I said, and this will be to our benefit, because that way I will have consulted with them ahead of time about what they think the position might need to be, and so that we would have actually gone through some sort of process where at least they were talked to ahead of time, and it would be easier to go there then. This turned out to be a very smart thing to do. I didn't know it at the time, but it turned out to be very good, because the people in the office, I sat down with some of the staff members in the office. I made appointments and went and saw John Torfey and John Wiley. And, yes, I remember Luis Pinheiro said, geez, I don't know. I'm not sure, you know, maybe you don't want to do this. You know, this is, you'll just be hanging out here, you know. You know, it's one of those positions where I don't see any career for you, Hank. I really don't. Well, the position didn't go anywhere. I understand what he was saying, but on the other hand, from my point of view, it was the experience of a lifetime. But it didn't have to go any further than that. But did I talk to you, Art? I can't remember.
I don't recall.
You would probably remember. I know. I talked to Joe Corey.
Yeah.
At that time, I'm trying to remember, Eric Borgerding was the state relations guy, and I talked with Eric. After 3 years in the chancellor's office, he kept calling me Godfather, because we were making lots of good arrangements with the legislature. He was having a lot of fun. Ultimately, he and I really hit it off to the point where we continue to get together, even presently, to talk about his career and where he's.
And he is now?
He went to WMC, then he became the senior vice president of the Hospital Association. So he's making more than we ever made, I'm sure, in those positions. Those are the biggest ones in the state. So we always had a good time sort of talking through that. But in any event, I went around and talked to all of those people, and I also visited with a couple of deans and associate deans that I knew, which in some ways resulted in two things. It established the fact that I was willing to ask them personal questions about something that I was considering, and it was also related to the work in a rather major way, and so it made it easier down the road to talk with those people later on. And I know it was a little unusual to do this, but one of the things that I perceived right away from some of the comments that I was getting from people is that a lot of people who worked in Bascom, and I later found out this to be true, tended to think that they were the princes and princesses of the campus. And so it was always the way I looked at the job anyway, was that you sort of ran for the job every day, because if you didn't have the support of all of the support staff and all of the, as many people as you could marshal, giving you information and telling you what's really going on and giving you advice and so forth, if you don't walk the halls, I mean, every morning I go into the chancellor's office and I just walk around and say hello to everybody. And they would say, well, while you're here, let me ask you a question. In other words, we'd get some business done, and then, because during the day, particularly during times of trouble, you were less available. So and we did morale building events. We immediately had a shower for Maria, who had just adopted a dog, so we had a dog shower, and everybody brought in dog gifts. Unfortunately, the dog had a dread disease and had to be put to sleep sometime thereafter, but at least at the time, this seemed like a, and she got another dog, it seemed like a good idea, and it was a good idea. And unfortunately, we had Chinese food, and we had fortune cookies, and so my assistant Cindy Haas and I carefully removed the fortune from Maria's fortune cookie and inserted one of our own that said, your dog will live long and prosper. Which turned out under the circumstances to be not entirely true. But anyway, I digress. So I went around and did all of those things, and I said, you know, we worked out the details, and I decided to go and do it. And so one afternoon, I can't remember, it was in the summer of 94, I simply went up to the chancellor's office and started working there. And it was remarkable to be, on one day worrying about scholarships in the School of Education, and then the next day being in the chancellor's office worrying about everything else. And looking back on it now, if I had known all of the things that I was ultimately going to have to worry about, I probably would have worried more that first day. But, you know, it didn't seem at any one time to be unmanageable, but it was initially something that took a while to just get used to. But summer was a good time to go up, and, you know, there were other things going on that were longer range projects, and it was a chance to go through the files and figure out the office procedures and figure out how it all worked.
Let me ask you one of the things.
And David and Judith and I went out to dinner because I had to meet the chancellor's wife. This was,
yeah,
talk about managing relationships.
Yes.
And that one is a critical one, and we went to, David and Judith knew my friend Dick Wagner, who's been a friend of mine since, you know, the 1960s, when we came out here to graduate school together, and he's had a substantial political career as chair of the county board and all the rest, and he and I are fast friends. And so the four of us went off to eat New Orleans food, and I would say that evening went just swell, and that over time, while other people reported to me that perhaps Judith Ward was hard to get along with, she and I had a very close relationship always, and she never, ever, ever once meddled, messed, did me wrong, caused a scene.
She at the time also was a member of the staff.
At the time, she was working for System as a vice president,
right.
And that was one of the, because David was still interim chancellor and then became chancellor, and She hadn't yet left system, though that was something that eventually she did do. And she had a considerable sense about how legislative politics went, and I think relatively sound one. Having the chancellor's wife with independent views on issues downtown didn't sit well with some of the staff, and there's always this tension between the spouse and the staff, generally anyway. To this day, I go and see David and Judith, and Judith and I have been off on adventures together, and she kept calling and trying to get me to apply for vice president positions at other universities. So we've had a very close relationship all the way along, which has far exceeded that of professional relationship. And I never saw her do anything that embarrassed anybody. But she could, however, be queen-like with others. I've perhaps seen that. So those are my initial recollections of those first relationships.
One of the things that I've observed with regard to successions from inside into the chancellor's offices, and David was a good example of it's like when you go from college football to pro football and everything speeds up and everything's happening all around you.
And the players are bigger.
Yes. Yeah. Now, did you experience that at the same time? All of a sudden, playing field has expanded and there are a lot more people out here and things are going faster and you've got to respond quickly to all these other things.
Yes. I would say that the two of my life experiences in part prepared me for the job. One of it was to have a minor area when I got my PhD in political science and international affairs, because really what you're doing a lot of times is trying to read communications or messages from external audiences or from one of your deans or somebody, which appears to be one thing, but you have to also hold open the opportunity that it might actually mean something else. And so I think that Leslie Geld was one of my the New York Times foreign policy writer, who since has passed away, who had a profound impact on me, because he was always describing these foreign policy adventures, and he would describe how Kennedy ignored Khrushchev's latest message and went back and responded to one that was earlier because he liked the one that was earlier better, and so the dialogue then switched back to the happier message and the terms of that message rather than the later bellicose one, and it turned out that things went faster, but at the same time, the management of information that I was getting and the decision to tell the chancellor or not tell the chancellor what I was hearing at various points in time was extremely important, and I was constantly making those judgments. And I think the management of that, as soon as people knew that they could be more or less candid with you, they would come in and say, why don't you try to get David to do this, blah, 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 because blah, blah, blah. And I wouldn't run into the chancellor and say, well, Joe said blah, 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 blah. I would say, boy, there's three points of view out here. We better, whatever it was. And so people began to become much more candid. So the president of the foundation then might say, can you get him to go to Texas, please? Or whatever it might be. And so people were always pitching you what they wanted the chancellor to do. And lots of times you were able to do that or not. And so eventually you the more you participate as a pivot point in these various kinds of issues, the more effective you can become, or the more dangerous you can become, I suppose, from the perspective of some other people, because suddenly you seem to be in all of them, which is what a chief of staff is supposed to do. And one of the deals that David and I had from the outset, and this was his point, was I want you in my office when I need a second ear for all of the meetings that I'm holding. And you can come into any meeting I have anytime, I suppose, unless it's something deeply personal or something like that. But any university business, you should come in. because I'm not very good at follow-up. I mean, he didn't put it that way. But one of the first things that I found myself doing in staff meetings and other things was making a list of what everybody agreed to do, and then going out and telling Cindy so that we would send reminders if they didn't do it. And that had the effect of curing a lot of the problems that the office had been having, where things just didn't seem to be happening. It was not that, it was in some cases not clear who was supposed to do something. And so if we got near the end of the meeting, I would say, I'm not clear, who's supposed to do that? You know, because it sometimes everybody would say, I want to do it, I want to do it, I want to do it. And the chancellor would say, okay, or whatever, but it was really fuzzy as to who was going to be the lead or who was going to do it. And so that was, I mean, one of the other things was to actually come out of those meetings with notes, because the staff who didn't go to the meetings, like the chancellor's personal assistant, felt she didn't have the faintest idea what she was supposed to do when these people called on the phone. And in fact, she didn't, because David Ward never really developed the art of sharing that information in the around the to the people who really needed to know it. So John Torfey might not know it, or the provost might not know it, or something like that, unless you had a list. And so we started to keep lists. And I had a folder for each of the key staff members, and I'd stuff stuff in there that they needed to know. And when they would pass through the office, they'd open the back door. They wouldn't come in the front door, obviously, to the chancellor's office. They'd come through my office, and they would stop, and they would say, is this a good day to talk to about money? Or they would say, how about those badgers? Or whatever they would say. And then if I had something to share with them that they wanted to know or should know, then I would open up the folder and tell them about it.
Yeah. How many people was that?
Not very many. It would be the provost and the vice chancellor for administration. It might be Melanie Newby, who at that time was the vice chancellor for legal. But she was pretty scattered in terms of keeping track of all this, and so I ultimately wound up calling Casey Nagy when he was up there, or John Dowling when he was up there, because those were the sort of the, what I would call, in the private parlance, a managing partner. This was the person that kind of kept all the team going with information and who's working on what and who has time to do something for you and that kind of thing. Certainly we needed to know, the state relations guy needed to know what we were doing, and sometimes would be brought in to call legislators to say something affecting your district or you or something you care about is about to happen.
Who was that at that time?
It was Eric Borgerding, and then later we hired Charlie Hoslett, who also became the people I met and worked with long term in the chancellor's office have tended to remain friends and tended to sit down with me and discuss their careers and those kinds of things. But that was I don't mean to make it sound like I came in and did all of those things right away. I think it would be fair to say that it took a good year or two to develop the style fully that, you know, ultimately I had then for the 8 years that I was there. But being the guard that brings the ball down the court. You never got to shoot, but you always knew who did. You know, that was one of the,
you always knew where everybody was on the court, too.
Yes, and over time, I think we developed a way. One of the other things that's critical in that office is for people to have face time with the boss. They don't want to come and talk to me. And if I tried to keep them from doing it, they'd be really mad, and eventually it wouldn't work. So the figuring out how to best use the chancellor's time with the staff, and eventually David developed a style of going downstairs and talking to them directly. He would say, okay, I'm going to go talk, I'll tell Eric. And he'd get up from behind his desk and run down the back stairs and go into his office. That way he hated meetings where people would make them and they would fluff and guff and carry on for a half an hour and really nothing happened. He'd much rather have a phone call or a an in-face that where you're really exchanging some information and then go away when you weren't. And so that was another one of those style issues. First going up there, it was a question of getting to know those people on a personal basis and then having to display to them that they could tell me something that I wouldn't necessarily tell the chancellor, and having to display to them that I actually would make people come to work on time if they stopped coming to work on time, that there were a few people who were maybe taking advantage of us. One of the things that we did relatively early on was to decide that what we really needed was a full-time community relations person. We had been sort of, there was an African-American from South Madison who did it, I want to say half-time or something, while also running some social service programs in South Madison, which were very good.
Who was that?
I knew you were going to ask.
Good old what's his name?
Good old what's his name? Nehemiah.
Oh.
What was that name?
First or last name?
No, Nehemiah was the group that he worked with in South Madison. It's funny. So we're continuing our discussion of the early days in the chancellor's office, and one of the things that I became involved with right away had to do with the university's local relationships, and we had, and the name is Alex G, G-E-E, who still is doing service programs in South Madison. He had been hired by the university to bring together the leaders of South Madison for an occasional meeting with the chancellor, and
these being primarily minority groups?
Minority groups, primarily, and people of color in South Madison. And they were wondering what the university was doing for students of color, for faculty and staff of color. And they knew that we were the big elephant at the zoo, but they didn't have any connection to us, really, unless they happened to be alumni. And the connections, such as they were awkward because the leaders of those communities would come to have a breakfast with the chancellor every so often, and he would talk about the latest developments. But there was no engagement with them other than that. There was no sense that they were a part of the university's programming and whatnot, even at the time we had lots of things going on in South Madison. The med school had programs, education had programs. So it wasn't as if the university collectively wasn't doing something, but there was no sense in which the institution was taking credit for all that we did. This remains a perennial problem. That's why everybody who goes to work in the chancellor's office the new chancellors come in and they say, well, let's just tell everybody what we do and then they'll love us, which is, of course, not the case, and you can never tell them all of what you do because it's too much. And if they hand you a big notebook filled with all this stuff about what you're doing, it doesn't mean anything to people because it's just, they can't get their arms around it. So actually what a lot of these external audiences want, like legislators who say, well, you're not doing anything for Washara County, and so when you go meet with them the next time and you take them a file folder of the things you're doing in Washara County, because you can usually find some things, they'll say, oh, that's very interesting. But what they really want is some kind of connection with you such that they will believe that the few things that you've told them about actually represents a significant commitment of the university to whatever issue it is, or part of the city, or part of the state. And what they really need is some way of feeling that they are engaging the leadership of the university in some meaningful fashion by having their advice solicited, 50-yard line tickets at Rose Bowls, whatever the way might be. We didn't have a particularly strategic campaign underway when we started this, and we were sort of feeling our way. And South Madison was an example where inviting the leaders in for breakfast is nice, but you need to have somebody on the ground who is with that group of people or springs from that group of people And the part-time commitment that we had made just wasn't working. So we undertook a search and hired a Chancellor Special Assistant for Community Relations. And that wasn't the only thing we did, because part of what I was doing for the Chancellor was continuing to call the City of Madison and all the managers that I knew and members of the City Council whom I knew when we had development issues or other things were coming along. And I wound up chairing the Community Relations Committee for a lot of our big buildings because I knew the council members and I knew how to go about the politics of that.
Who was the person that came in then at that point?
We hired Lamar Billups, and what a wonderful hire. He, highly respected African-American, who had been working at, he was actually working at the time in Washington for Senator Feingold, and was looking to come back to Madison. He'd had an extensive state agency career, but beyond that, he had started community scholarship programs for people in Madison to come to the university and had enormous connections through the political apparatus and through his own social service work. He and his wife are extraordinarily popular people. And so his presence on downtown Madison committees and South Madison committees, and so he was actually out from the university working in this, working with this leadership structure. And he was also doing it very effectively with the City Council and eventually in other groups too. He became a spokesperson for the university, and my direct involvement with community relations fell off sharply thereafter. But that was something that...
That was an immediate need that you had to resolve.
And we resolved it, yes. And it was... we stopped having the breakfasts and we started having some real participation and involvement. And I'm not saying that we weren't very careful. We were very careful in using the events that the Chancellor sponsored. The holiday parties, the football brunches, the community relations events that we had the opportunity to invite people to the campus with. And we dreamed up some more. During the sesquicentennial, for example, we had a whole variety of local programs that brought all kinds of people to the campus for different types of programs. But one of the things that we started to do for the first time was to identify who are the key audiences that we needed to connect with as a chancellor's office. And it turned out when I went in that there was a scheduling committee that met regularly to advise the Chancellor on which invitations that he received, and hopefully the Chancellor would stop sort of making ad hoc acceptances of various events on the street and then suddenly say, I never agreed to do that, and we would say, you did too. Why, it was right in front of the union. And he'd say, oh geez, I've completely forgot that. So eventually we had to train the Chancellor, of course, not to make ad hoc acceptances of invitations, and he came to love the scheduling committee because he said, ah, I have a committee. Everybody's got a committee, I have a committee. I have to get my schedule through them. They're the ones that tell me what to do. So, but what we started to do then was to become much more tactical with the information and the meetings that he would subject himself to and the social events. And we began buying tables to the Urban League dinner and a variety of other community events, and we would all go to these downtown Madison, and we would go, and all of a sudden the university was there, which it hadn't been before, at least not to this degree, with sort of an on-the-ground approach. And we kept track of all of the individuals whom we knew we needed to get to the campus at least once a year. We made sure that they came. So we had, all of a sudden we began to keep statistics. And at one point, and how many receptions did people come to? Because all of a sudden we realized that we kept seeing the same old faces and we were entertaining ourselves too much. And we weren't entertaining the public enough. For some people, I averaged 84 events every year that I was in the Chancellor's office. Because in part, The chances were usually...
You personally arranged them?
Oh, no, personally, I went to them.
Oh, you went to them. Okay.
We also had a part-time Olin House events coordinator, Peg Davey, who was extremely good at it. But after you do 6 or 7 years of these events, you say, if I see one more product, I'm going to scream. And so she went off into a slightly different direction, and we hired Ellen Cipher, who is still doing events for John Wiley. She's the event coordinator par excellence. She's on the door. She never forgets anybody. I mean, she remembers names. She has all sorts of great suggestions for how to liven parties. I mean, part of the problem is that the people who are putting on the parties eventually burn out on them, and so you have to constantly reevaluate the format of the event as well as everything else, because it's Saturday morning, it must be time for brunch, only goes for so long before you really want to try something else, new menus and all these other
things. My own experience, I tell people I spent most of my professional career organizing events that I'd never voluntarily go to on my own. I can relate to that.
I think that's right. And so we had this committee, which we enlivened and brought more people into.
Which is
called the scheduling committee. Right. But the scheduling committee also began to be the event planning committee. And so we had, and we also had a very constructive schedule for football brunches. So we would have the chamber board on this particular Saturday, and then we would have the Urban League board on this particular Saturday, and we would try to do local community, and then we would do regents and legislators, so that so people could come and do business.
Right.
So actually what people liked about these events, and I suppose I did too, I'd always go to these events with a couple of index cards. This was before
PD.
PD, whatever they are, is
personal desk assistants, PDAs, or whatever they are.
Isn't that a public display of affection?
Yeah.
Anyway, I would always go with index cards, and I have a collection of them somewhere here, of the notes that I would take at these various, you know, Chancellor told Governor he would tell him where he bought his sunglasses.
Right.
Whatever it might be, they were usually things like that, so that we would be able to follow up on them. But people would like to come to these events, and I still see it. I faithfully attend the Chancellor's Christmas party or holiday party every year, and I watch it. You would think that the deans were starved for company with one another, because they'll all run right across the room and form a tight knot and talk as fast as they can, and then what they're really doing is business. They're not expressing delight in seeing one another or the outfits they're wearing or something like that. So if you're really hoping that these events will be a way to knit the community to the university together and so forth, they don't do that unless one of the deans happens to have something going on with somebody from the community. So what we would try to do then was to say, okay, and this is by year 4 or 5, when we got smarter about this, we would have an annual program in the summer where we would honor the university's programs in the community. This still goes on. And we would pick a half a dozen illustrative programs of, you know, day camp for the people on Northport Drive, and, you know, urban farming program, or whatever they might be. They were always all over the map, and we would take them all to the backyard at Olin House, and we would give out prizes, and everybody would get together, and the deans would come and talk to their community people, and so forth, and that worked out. We would try to do these symbolic events, which in isolation would seem like just sort of froth. But in fact, they are ways that's a part of a concerted strategy to see those people and to get to know them. And that way, the community people would be coming into these program events too, and they would see what was going on. And that's the same thing that we did with the Chancellor's travel around the state, rather than just having him pop up at a service club somewhere, which we liked to do, by the way. That night, then, we would have an alumni reception in that community and give the local legislator a prize or some damn thing. And in other words, we were trying to cross the audiences and use the time and the events and the chancellor all together as a package to further an agenda, rather than having these isolated things.
How would you measure the effectiveness effectiveness of these then afterwards in terms of if they accomplish what you would hope they would, that is greater understanding, plus then the people who attended the events would become missionaries for you in some way or another.
See, the naive approach, and in fact, I hear Peyton Smith still talking like this even today. The naive approach on this is, well, if we just tell everybody in the state of Wisconsin how great we are, everything will be fine. And we know already that there's a wellspring of affection here for us. But when you ask those same people who say we're one of the things that makes Wisconsin great, if we should have any more money, they say, no, they're doing fine without any more money. So it's useless in terms of, but nevertheless, I see this with every new dean. How many times have I had to tell the dean of the School of Education that we're really wasting our time publishing a list of the 250 programs that we have in Dane County? We just published one of those. I wouldn't say it was a waste of time. I would say the current dean's efforts to bring the school superintendents to town, we're going to take them all down to the terrace for brats in a couple of weeks. That's worth a whole pile of programs with 250 things in it, because that's actually putting a face on the institution and going out there, and now those people have a place to call and so forth. In terms of what I think it was all about, we had a finite number of regents, and throughout this period the Chancellor had a group called the Chancellor's Council, which were a group of very senior, usually former regents and corporate leaders, usually Republicans, usually with very close ties to the Republican governor. And those people delivered time and time again. So I always thought that the campaign was for newspaper editors and for the biggies that could influence the legislative process, otherwise known as the economic elite, and that was what we were really, that was our strategy, and the alumni awards for the legislator or the events that honor our five or six community programs or whatever, that's really for the newspaper editor that you get to come to that event, and that's really for a lot of other people that, and not for the nice people whose programs are being honored, though of course we like that too. But in terms of the politics of the place and the politics of the university or politics of higher education, I think universities in a state structure are competing for attention with legislators, and we need to try to figure out who can get at them. And then the second thing is, with the enormous growth of donations and gift income, on the one hand, that's a way to show the Bascom Hill Society and all of those donors that the place is on the move, that we've got all of these. So all of a sudden, a lot of our donors in Wisconsin are seeing us out there popping up, and by the way, the Chancellor stopping by with the donors while you're on these trips. And so you begin to have these multi-purpose opportunities, and you get eventually the donors see, and yes, you hand them the 250 programs that we're doing in Dane County, and eventually the donors say, wow, this place is really doing a lot, which is the only message you really wanted to get across in the first place, was we're doing a lot, because we'll never know how many of them there are. And then you can, I think donors want a couple of things. They want to know that their money's going to be used wisely, and that's a management question. They got to respect the Chancellor and the Dean, and they also got to know that the thing they're giving the money for is a need. And then they've got to say, hey, this place is really on the move. I feel good about giving my money to this place at this time. So that's always going around here. That's why one of the things that we did over time was to make sure that the foundation and the fundraising arm of the university was with us and in the planning of all of these events, and the alumni association was with us in the planning of all of these events and activities, because once you get them, and athletics, in other words, once you get all of these big fish at the table, or that's a terrible metaphor, once you bring all of these folks to the table, and they begin to see how this could really maximize their opportunities, they get excited about it.
That sounds like a good place to end. Let's pick up the next time with some other key issues that feel important to you.